Tonight on The Download, we reload the news with Chicago Tribune reporter Jeff Cohen and WYCC host Lauren Cohn. Also, Chicago Tribune Inc. columnist Tracy Swartz. And live music from singer-songwriter Trevor Sensor. Now, here's your host, a man who shoves his way to the front of every photo op, Justin Kaufman.
It's just the way to be. That's the way to be American. You just get to the front. Really want to let people know what kind of person you are? Get to the front. That's our motto. Get to the front. Before the cast, I forgot to say that the news is sponsored by MidwestLaundries.com. And if I were going to be someone who actually was on Rob about messing up words, I'd be as hypocritical as a politician. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. This is one of my favorite nights of the year to broadcast. The beginning of Memorial Day weekend where people are heading out of town. They're getting ready for their first big holiday weekend. They want to get somewhere. Most of Chicago offices got off maybe around 2 o'clock this afternoon. People are starting their time off. And I don't know, there's something about the idea of this night, you know, where everyone is in their car driving distances and they're listening to the radio, that I feel honored and distinguished, and I feel I feel humbled to be on Chicago radio on a night like this. I really do. I think we talked about this last year too. Like, there's something really great about what this time of night right now, 7 o'clock on a Friday before Memorial Day means to everybody. So I'm glad to put a show together tonight for you. And we got a great one coming up. San Panionovich going to talk about the Cubs and Sox as they wrap up the month of May this weekend. We're also going to talk about the NBA Finals and which team we should root for. I'm not even sure. I mean, Sam and I were having a conversation that could there be two least liked teams? You know, everyone loves the Warriors, I guess, because of all the stars, but the way that they were put together. And then on the other side, it's LeBron James. And, you know, I think there's this relationship, not just because he's a rival here in Chicago, but because, I mean, effectively he's gunning for Michael Jordan's legend. So I don't even know who I want. I don't know who I want to win in this one. I liked last year that LeBron James came out of nowhere and willed a win. That was great sport. But I don't know. You know, I mean, I like Steph Curry. He's mentioned more in rap songs. You know, I guess that's which new rappers are mentioning who. Like, I heard a new rap song where they mentioned DeRozan in Toronto. So maybe he's the new guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a deep cut.
What was the line? It says, "I'm like DeRozan, whatever I throw up goes in."
Oh, that's genius. That's
genius. I was like, that's great. Maybe it was another Toronto rapper. I don't know. So we'll talk with Sam about sports. Also, we'll reload this week's news. Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen. I'm going to have trouble with that all night. Cohen and Cohn. It's kind of like the Simon and Simon of news analysis. Cohen and Cohn coming up. We got a lot to talk about, including a late arrival story about Jared Kushner. And it's coming out now that there is intelligence that says that he was trying to create a back channel to the Russian government for Trump to talk to Putin. We'll talk about what that means in the overall ongoing investigation into collusion with Russia. If this is a bombshell, and it's a Friday night, Memorial Day weekend. I love how that comes out. So I'm not sure if it's a bombshell. There's just nothing else to talk about. But we'll find out. We'll talk about it with Jeff and Lauren coming up here in the 8 o'clock. Also tonight, Tracy Swartz is going to join us from the Inc. column at Chicago Tribune for a new segment, The Reality. I think it's either that or Reality Bites, but I liked The Reality. And this is something we talked about doing months ago, but this concept of talking about Chicago's relationship, who's on the shows, what our show and where it's set. There's some reality shows that are set here. But talking about reality TV and Chicago. And, of course, we have to talk about The Bachelorette. Four contestants from Chicago are on this year's Bachelorette. One of them already gone. I think he was the first dude out. So we'll talk with Tracy about that. And then Trevor Sensor, singer-songwriter, who's really kind of blowing up. We had him on a year ago almost to the date, to perform in studio. He's going to be with us tonight. We'll talk to him about his new album, which is coming out in June. News, weather, and, of course, traffic with Rob Martier and Roger Badish tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, we'll hit the carryout coming up after the news. We'll get back on time here, because if we're going to do the carryout, then I feel like we won't hear Rob Martier again until like 9:30. Never good, right? I have a lot of fun, and I would never, ever do it any other way, especially when it comes to talking with Ro and Anna in the crosstalk. But sometimes we get carried away, and tonight with Jared Kushner talk, we did our segment early. So we'll hit the why don't we do this? We'll get Rob ready for the news. We'll do the news, and then we'll come back after the news. We'll do the carryout. Does that sound good? Let's do the carryout, shall we? All right, here are today's top stories. So what does the Kushner news mean? Well, it means that we're going to have a real heavy Trump-Russia holiday weekend. Just when we thought we could grill out and have a fun weekend without talk about Trump and Russia, well, that's been squashed. We'll talk about all this coming up when we reload the news at 8 o'clock. Hillary Clinton gave a commencement speech today at Wellesley College and did better than most stand-ups. Jokes about laundry and grandkids are just killing it on college campuses these days. She also went to chastise Trump, invoke Nixon, beat up on the proposed budget. I'll tell you all about the speech, but you know what? I'll just email you. Some critics say that Clinton should just stop talking about Donald Trump since she lost the election. I'd usually say absolutely yes, but then you'd have to say that the president should stop talking about how she lost the election, right? Let's all agree that nobody wants either of them to talk about either of them again. Are we cool? I think we're cool. Chinese fighter jets intercepted our Navy jets off the South China Sea today and did unsafe maneuvers, like throw on the brakes and let them fly right by. We're buzzing the tower. That's pretty much all I know about fighter jets. Right, Lou Gossett Jr., was he involved? No one was hurt, but it adds to the tension in that part of the world as our militaries judge the size of each other's carriers. Big weekend in Chicago. Traditionally, this weekend is a violent one, so we'll see what's in store for police and communities. The superintendent said they'll have 1,300 extra cops patrolling this weekend. But as we heard last night from FOP President Kevin Graham, a lot of the officers are being called in on days off, and that could mean a fatigued force. Something to pay attention to. The police started the weekend with, quote, Operation Bunny Trap, which is not about keeping the bunnies away from my flowers. That's what I thought at first. Maybe it was. Nope, it's about seizing guns and arresting gangbangers on the South Side. 50 arrests after a two-year probe. One of the arrestees was a violence interrupter with Ceasefire, who the police say allegedly was also a gangbanger. How does that work? That's quite a conflict. I wonder if this dude was targeting other gangs just to get him off the streets, so more turf for him. You got to get off the streets for a better life. And so I can have this block. Seriously, I need this block. Political mascots are back. Remember when Rauner had the Quinocchio mascot that would follow Quinn during the last gubernatorial campaign? Well, that really worked, because I guess that's the 21st century political playbook. Democrat candidate J.B. Pritzker introduced today, TikTok the budget clock. A guy who dresses in a felt clock costume is going to chase Governor Rauner around to remind him the clock is ticking on the budget crisis. Really? Is there one political consultant group that focuses on mascots, and do they get paid? Or is it just a hobby? Or do you think this was conjured up by the intern in the office? I got an idea. I give TikTok the budget clock 1 star. First, because clocks can't be mascots. Second, because it's a mascot, right? Do we really need that in Illinois politics right now? More felt costumes? Who's paying for these felt costumes? If I find out I'm paying for these felt costumes, I mean, it's one thing with all the face paint and the Quinocchio. I mean, that was really good. There's a lot that went into that. I've ordered felt costumes in the past. It costs money. If I find out, that's an investigation right there. Well, if it wasn't enough for you to get sick by the food, now Chipotle's letting us know that their credit card information was compromised by malware. So 2 strikes. I mean, if they go one step further and say, take the barbacoa off the menu, I'm done. Until then, more corn, please. I'll take a little bit more corn. What do you got with the little tomatoes? So this news will freak you out. Scientists say that snakes may actually hunt in packs. So a pack of wild snakes could be slithering closer to your porch right now. So enjoy the weekend. Chicago beaches are open, but the water is super cold. No tornado watch. Tornado watch and dangerously cold water. So enjoy the beach, but don't. It's a perfect metaphor for life right now, isn't it? And of course, this is the Memorial Day weekend where everyone trashes the beach as if it's some sort of tradition. So if you go to the beach this weekend, pick up your Dorito bag. That's all we're asking, right? In weather, tornado watches, which I guess is like Baywatch without the boy shorts. No. Tornado watches and warnings. Come on, appropriate way to kick off the big summer weekend by scaring us indoors. In sports, we'll skip the sports because Sam Penianovich is coming in to talk about all the stuff I have, except for the fact that it is 90s weekend at the Cell. And some of the guys will be back. Bobby Howery, Keith Foulke, James Baldwin. The Sox have to be one of the only teams in sports that continually reference an unfinished season as part of their glorified past. We would have won if there wasn't a strike. And to honor everybody who was part of the team that could have won if we didn't have a strike. Here's your almost rings. And finally tonight, somehow it's Friday and we already know who won the weekend box office. Pirates of the Caribbean looks to be the winner. I can't tell if this is a sequel or a remake, which I guess doesn't matter because it's got Johnny Depp. Baywatch is also out and doesn't look good. I think it's pretty obvious why the movie didn't do well. Which of the movie stars posed in Playboy, right? I mean, they didn't? Oh, well, do you think we really watched the TV show with Pamela Anderson and Donna DeErico for the lifeguarding form? I mean, seriously, you got to take it all off, Rock. All of it. I mean, that's just Baywatch. All right, that's a carryout for May 26, 2017. If you're attending International Mail Leather this weekend, we've got coupons. All right, Penianovich in studio next. Cubs, Sox, and which team should we root for and against in the NBA Finals? It's a tough call. Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, take me out to the ball game. Sammy Panionovich in studio, WGN Radio Sports. Talk about the Cubs and the Sox as they wrap up May this weekend. You know, it's funny, at the beginning of the month or maybe somewhere in there, Cubs fans were worrying if there was trouble on the north side. What's wrong with the Cubs? They're three back, three and a half back. Today, the Chicago Cubs, after making easy work of the San Francisco Giants, are a game and a half up, first place in the NL Central as the Cardinals fade away. It's early. But, Sam, I mean, there's something to be said that there's a lot of worry and anxiety around a team that just won the World Series.
I heard the Cubs are back now. That's what I heard. I heard they're back. Last week, we had to trade everybody. This week, they're back. They go 7-2 on their homestand, get good pitching from Lester and Hendricks. I mean, you don't look for so many big-picture things with this group because they did just win the World Series. You look at the minor things. How will the pitching staff recover from a long offseason, or from a long postseason, rather, and, yeah, you know, not much rest, win a World Series? Did you really work out as hard as you should have after you drank all that champagne and beer all offseason? So there are some slings and arrows that come your way when you win a championship. But I think the three biggest questions were the rotation. They've been really good. Leadoff man, no more Schwarber.
Yeah.
Finally.
Zobrist.
Not a leadoff hitter. Never was a leadoff hitter. Never going to be a leadoff hitter. Zobrist seems like he can fill that hole. The other hole, the bullpen. You lose Chapman. Wade Davis has been really good. And Carl Edwards Jr. has been good. So the three biggest questions that I had going into the season have already been answered. I mean, let's just get to September and October. And as long as they stay healthy, they'll be there.
Do you see the Cubs making any moves? Do they need to add any players, remove any players from this mix?
Need a pitcher. Now, I don't like to play armchair GM, and I don't like to trade guys because what I say does get in that locker room. And when you go on and say, they should trade Schwarber, and they should trade Happ, and they should trade this guy and that guy, I'm not going to say that. But eventually, you have to move some of these young position players, which they all don't have a full-time role. Some of them don't have, you know, a path to playing every day. So you can't play everybody. You can only play eight guys in the field, and they've got, like, 12 really good position players. Ideally, you flip one of them for a pitcher. That John Lackey in the four hole is not going to work long term. Doesn't have it anymore. He's past his prime. He's like almost 40 years old. You need to get a pitcher.
Now, are you talking like a serviceable guy that's just kind of off the shelf, or are you talking about getting an ace?
I'm talking about flipping a couple prospects in the top 10 and trying to get a Chris Archer from Tampa, a Gerrit Cole from Pittsburgh. Mm. You know who makes the most sense? Jose Quintana. He really does. He's under team control.
He's had a terrible year.
So what? It doesn't matter. Yeah. He has two good starts before the break, and you're like, oh, yeah. You put a bib on, you like, you know, you start slamming your silverware, you're ready because you need what is out there. And right now on the market, he's on the market. He's the best starting pitcher on the market because of his ability to perform over a long period of time, and then he's also under team control through 2020.
Hmm. Okay, so the Chicago Cubs are in Los Angeles tonight against the Dodgers. The Dodgers, surprising to me, they're 28-20, 8 games over .500, which is 3 better than the Cubs at this point, and they're in third place in the NL West. The NL West has the Rockies at the top and the Diamondbacks in the two-hole. I mean, it's pretty amazing that the NL West is kind of running away with Major League Baseball right now.
And the Dodgers are right there in the wild card. I mean, they're in the second wild card spot. And remember, when baseball implemented that second wild card, it was to increase the parity. And when with that second wild card spot, teams that are now like 6, 7, 8, and 9 think, oh, we can get in still, right? Because there's two wild cards. Mm-hmm. Back then, there were 3 playoff teams, the division winners, and then the best team from the rest of the pack. Now with those 2 wild card teams, a lot more teams are buyers than sellers. But you're right, the NL West has been great. I mean, Arizona and Los Angeles lead the wild card in the West, and then the first place team, you talked about it, Houston, they're 32-16. Houston, and they did kind of what the Cubs did.
Well, Houston is in the AL West, and that's they're the
number. Oh, right, right. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry about that.
The Rockies are the number one in the
West. Yeah, you're right.
But I do want to ask about the Astros. Remind me of last year's Cubs. There are a lot of young players, guys that even the year before, you're like, wow, look at all these guys. They may be short in arm, but they seem to be running away with the AL West, which was not necessarily in the cards. And I would say maybe running away with the AL at this point, the most wins in baseball.
They hit the crap out of the baseball. I mean, they got a bunch of guys that are hitting around 300, and they're fast. They steal a lot of bases. Their prospects are all promising. Jose Altuve is having a down year for now, but they've got so much depth
Correa,
in that lineup.
Correa, the shortstop. Yeah, Correa
is
Springer,
awesome.
The out. I mean, they got so many good players. All right, let me ask you about let's shift to the AL. Let's shift to the White Sox. The White Sox, almost the exact opposite storyline as the Cubs. At the beginning of May, we're like, what a surprise. They're doing it. This could be the team. And they came down to earth on the West Coast trip where they, besides a great showing in Seattle, have really just kind of been overmatched or undermatched, if you will.
Seattle's one of the only teams that's worse than the White Sox.
Yeah,
so,
right.
I mean, you should beat Seattle. Seattle is terrible. This is what happens. You know, you get off to a good start and, you know, the optimism ramps up and people wonder, well, you know, maybe this is the year. And then again, May is the most humbling month. For the second year in a row. I just hope they finish what they started. I talked about this the other day. I have this fear that the Reinsdorfs are like, well, look at AAA. Lewis Robber, Moncada, look at what you got. Maybe we keep Quintana now. And it's like you should finish what you started.
Yeah.
And you should trade everybody that you can get anything back in return for. Because that's the way you do it. That's what he started. That's what this is. But they're so competitive in that front office, and they hate the word rebuild. They hate the word tank. Reinsdorf doesn't like to tank anything. So I just hope they do what they have to do, trade the Quintanas and the Robertsons, the Jennings. If you could trade Melky, if you could trade Frazier, just get them all out and get more young players because they have a bunch of them right now.
Well, I mean, it seems more often than not, the headlines coming off the South Side is what's happening in Charlotte. Lucas Giolito throws a no-hitter over 7 innings. I was confused by that. But I don't know why everyone jumped out of the dugout after the 7th inning, but I don't understand minor league baseball, I guess. And Yoan Moncada comes off the DL. Do we see any of these players? I mean, Moncada is now past that point where the year counts and whatever that Chris Bryant garbage that we know in baseball. Well, is there any chance that we see these guys come up and give them an extended shot?
You could see Moncada in July. You could see him in August. I think you do. Zach Birdie, the pitcher, their closer down in Charlotte. He throws 100 out of Louisville. He was one of their first-round picks last year. I think he's on the fast track, but there's no rush. This isn't a playoff team. I'd be surprised if they're in contention in August. Honestly, I would, because I think the goal of the franchise coming into the season was to get younger and to flip players that have good years flip them for younger players, mm-hmm. like the Cubs did through from 12, 13, and 14 when they traded Paul Mahalam and then they traded, you know, Ryan Dempster, and they traded guys like that to
Samardzija,
get younger.
Right.
Traded Samardzija and got a lot of young players in return. That's the goal here. Finish what you start. You have to.
All right, let's Sam Panionovic in studio. We're talking baseball. Let's switch to basketball. The NBA Finals are set.
Are the Bulls still playing?
They're still
no?
playing.
No? Oh?
You know, there's
Wait,
so,
what they, happened?
I don't know if it's just storyline and if the idea is that we want to sort of make as much drama as we possibly can for the playoffs. But right before the playoffs started, they're like, well, the Cavaliers look damaged. LeBron's, no, this could be the year that the Celtics knock them off. And all we see is the same thing we saw the year before and what we'll probably see for the next couple of years. The Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors back in the NBA Finals. Is this Celtics-Lakers? What are we seeing here in terms of NBA history?
This is the trilogy. And by the way, you didn't have me on because I didn't think anybody was going to go besides these two. I mean, I told you back in December.
I know.
We could talk about the regular season and all you want. There were two or three teams that could win the whole thing. I thought it was San Antonio, Golden State, Cleveland. San Antonio ran into Golden State with four All-Stars. Cleveland has pretty much three, four All-Stars. It is two super teams. With the supervillain LeBron James, I mean, I go back and forth. Do I care who wins? Do I like either team? And it's funny because I don't know if I have the answer to that. With Golden State, you rooted for them when they hadn't won yet. Then last year they win. Or 2 years ago they win. Last year they win 73. Are they better than the Bulls? So you're like, hell no, I'm not rooting for them anymore.
Right.
And now LeBron, who has pretty much engineered every situation he's been in, since 2010, I want this coach, I want this player, I don't want him, I like him. It's just, I don't know. The league has changed. I don't know about the likability of the star team because they're all forced together.
Durant has been fending off, he's been defensive and criticism that, yeah, what does it say about parity? You know, you cherry-picked to come to the Golden State Warriors. He seems to be the poster child of the new NBA.
Well, it started with Garnett. I mean, it even happened in the 80s with the Sixers, but that was an older group that they got into their 30s and then they wanted to go win a ring. LeBron left Cleveland when he was 25. He was the chosen one, and then he's like, ah, I've seen enough. I'm going to go to Miami. Bosh and Wade start to get old. They start to get hurt. I'm coming home. It's just like whatever's best for him, he's going to go for. But that's the pressure we put on him initially when we called him the chosen one at 16. And then the biggest knock on him was doesn't have a ring. So then he left to go to Miami to get a ring. And then he wins a ring and we say, well, he did it this way. But it's a very interesting web.
Does the impact we're seeing in sports circles online, the discussion we see on SportsCenter and all the others is Michael Jordan.
Oh, God. Why do we always have to compare them?
I mean, LeBron James, of course, passed Jordan in playoff scoring.
No, 33 more games, though. He played 33 more playoff games. Jordan scored at a more.
You don't tell me. I mean, I understand.
At a more profound rate.
The idea, though, that if LeBron James once again can come in and knock off, I mean, really, Goliath in the Golden State Warriors, does he have what it takes to be compared to or be better than Michael
Jordan? Of course
Jordan?
He could be compared to him. Of course. I mean, he's already in the conversation. He's been to more finals. Now, granted, everybody talks about 6-0. I'm biased because I grew up with Michael Jordan. I only know Michael Jordan as a champion. You know, when I was 9 years old, he had six rings, I'm sorry. So I only know him as a winner. So it's unfair to ask me that. But, I mean, if you look at what LeBron does in this league, I mean, there's no player ever like him. There really isn't. Like him, hate him, love him, want to fight him, whatever. You have to respect what he does. He's the best player on both sides of the floor.
Who wants to fight LeBron?
Oh, a lot of people.
Do you want to fight LeBron?
The gutters of the internet. They want to fight him here.
Yeah,
they
right.
My favorite thing is when LeBron scores 11 and then all the Jordan haters are like, oh, Mike never scored 11.
Right.
Okay, whatever. We cling to Jordan like he's some shrine.
He is.
He is.
How dare you?
How dare I?
It is fun to watch Scottie Pippen. Scottie Pippen has been on The Jump on ESPN.
His suits fit him yet?
Yeah, and he is.
Oh, they do?
He's becoming. I saw the other day. It's amazing. It was Pippen, Paul Pierce, and Tracy McGrady was the panel on ESPN talking about basketball.
They were
talking about Derrick Rose going to the Timberwolves and Tom Thibodeau and whether or not that's going to happen this summer. Last thought. You think that might happen? You think Derrick Rose goes to the Timberwolves?
Tibbs respects him. I know that. It's all about the money. How much money is he willing to take? Now, Derrick, his camp, they think he's a max player. He's not a max player. He can't stay on the floor. But I do think if there's one coach that will take a chance on him, Tom Thibodeau's in the conversation because of what Derek did when he was in Chicago. I mean, Tibbs does respect guys that fight, guys that he knows well, guys that know his system. But Derek, unfortunately, is just a shell of his former self. I mean, you have three knee surgeries. You're just not what you used to be.
Sam Panionovich, have a great Memorial Day weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Stay dry.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. My favorite segment of the week. Rewind. Reloading the news. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. Lauren, radio TV personality here in Chicago. She hosts In the Loop at WYCC. Lauren, great to see you.
I like this Cohen and Cohen thing.
It's going to screw me up crazy tonight. Jeff Cohen, of course, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Good to see you, Jeff.
Sir.
All right, so we got a lot to talk about tonight. We reload. Okay, so you know how this works. We've got biggest story. We've got overreported, underreported, winners, losers. What story sucked you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from? What are they going to put on the caves? They're going to scrawl this story on the cave from this week. That's what we're doing tonight. Like I said, 312-981-7200. Let's get right to the biggest. And I have to say, I mean, we kind of already had tossed the stories around, and just like the news cycle does to us, a late Friday entry into the mix. Jared Kushner and reports that he was trying to create a back channel for secret communications with Russia. This is not a great look for Jared Kushner and the Trump administration right now.
It isn't, but I love the story because it gets sexier by the minute. It's like, where's Tom Clancy? Is he sitting there getting ready to write his next book?
Right.
You know, it reminds me, do you guys remember the game Clue? Is it going to be Professor Plum in the library with the candlestick? This story is so awesome and yet not awesome because we don't have no idea, you know, what really happened and where is the collusion, if there is collusion.
Right.
But it couldn't be a better story for journalists to be watching. And I mean, now that the inner circle is getting, you know, more attention. Oh, and the new information that came out about the FBI director and
James Comey.
James Comey and what he knew regarding the emails and reportedly not disclosing that, knowing that Russia had, you know, sort of made up that story. I can't keep up, Jeff.
Yeah, it's basically daily at this point. Every day at the end of the day, it's like the New York Times guys and women now. And the Washington Post, likewise, they just wait to see the other crew leave, and then they throw their latest thing up on the internet.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, on the elevator ride down here, I may have missed something. So.
Well, I mean, for you, covering this story or just sort of paying attention to the story, what does the Jared Kushner angle, what we found out tonight that he was trying to create a back channel, secret communications, that's the wording in the Washington Post.
Right.
What does that mean? I read the Washington Post analysis that said this is the biggest sort of smoke, you know, this is the most smoke we've seen from this story.
Well,
is it a big deal?
I think it is. It is a big deal one way or the other. There's really only a couple. Well, let's say it's true. It's either the question becomes, why do you want this? You're either very naive and think you can do it, or you are naive about the way the system works, or you actually have something to hide or something to discuss with the Russians that you want to try to avoid any scrutiny on. So I think that's, you know, it's a problem either way, really.
And by the way, Michael Flynn was there too, reportedly. So, you know, there's another link. And what is the arrogance of this family? You know, what is he doing there? Okay, maybe he's talking to a banker, some disguise of they're doing business. We've done business with Russia. I mean, there's such an arrogance about the way this plays out with this family, including the president, who's, you know, making decisions over chocolate cake or, you know, making comments to the, you know, FBI director, am I under investigation? I think this is some narcissism that we're seeing that maybe it goes to Kushner as well, that they're sort of above the law or above protocol.
And I guess the question is protocol, that's a great word. It's not illegal necessarily, but it definitely is the decorum, the protocol, everything involved in how you're supposed to act when you're in the White House is on display.
Well,
here.
And it's a special problem too, because Kushner's so close to the president and has basically been given, you know, a crazy number of responsibilities and jokes about the things that Trump has turned over to Jared Kushner. So I think for me, one interesting thing is going to be, what does Team Trump do with this now? I mean, what's the next play? Can you claim that it's just flat out not true? Can you claim that it was misconstrued? Because if you read into the story, this was discovered by monitoring of this being called into Moscow.
Right.
So you could see them saying, well, this is not exactly what Jared was trying to communicate. Maybe they conflated it. Maybe this is an ambassador to the United States trying to impress his boss and come up with a story that makes it sound like, you know, right here at the beginning of the new administration that, you know, I've got a winning play already. So, I mean, can they claim it's false? Kushner doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that they're going to cut. I mean, in a normal circumstance, I mean, the White House like this in a normal administration, they'd shelve them right away and say, whatever this is, you got to, you know, take a time out. I don't think that happens.
It's just the story keeps continuing where I guess the question I have, because you hear this, it's now starting to bubble up, that do the American people care? Do the voters who voted for Donald Trump, do they care that there's back channels with Russia? Is this kind of story over everybody's head in the way that it's not, you know, corruption as we know it, it's collusion, it's a different kind of thing? Is this going to have any sort of indelible impact on the Trump administration or how people think of them?
I think it absolutely will for two reasons. I think, though, first to Jeff's point, what you're going to see is optics. They're so good at changing the narrative. I definitely will give, whatever you like about his politics, that the president and his team around him are good at changing the narrative. So they'll throw out, you know, Kushner's attorneys on top of this saying he'll talk to anybody, and the FBI's casting a wide net. But to your point, the bigger story is, where are we with Russia? I mean, to me, that's the story of the American people when we're thinking, worrying about Kim Jong-un and missiles in North Korea. What is going on in terms of a second Cold War here? I mean, we have a massive amount of NATO military in the Baltics. The West and Russia are fighting over the Ukraine. And then we've got Russian warplanes and U.S. warplanes over Syria. And now, you know, Trump's going to come out and say, well, we're going to keep the sanctions against Russia. Mm-hmm. What is really going on here?
Yeah, and what is this all about? I mean, why are you reaching out for back channels and secret communication when the allegations are that the Russians helped or colluded in helping to elect President Trump?
Yeah, but you can see them blaming the media again. I mean, everything's the media's fault and liberal America's view of them. So they could maybe come out and say, well, we thought we needed a back channel because the regular channels, we can't just march, you know, the ambassador into the White House. We'll be, you know, pepper sprayed for weeks in the press. We need to come up with something that was a little bit cleaner and free of that kind of influence. I don't know.
I think the American people are interested in this because, you know, his approval rating is very low right now. And I know that we're concerned about domestic issues that are very important, but I think this just has so many legs that, I mean, everyone I talk to seems to be interested in it.
And it's funny, too. You know, this was, I mean, even without the Kushner story that just broke, I mean, that's it's in the circle. It's in the cycle this week, and it made it into our list. Not necessarily the biggest. I mean, this overshadows a terrorist attack in Manchester, which was probably up to this point the biggest story of the week, and so many other stories, even locally with the tax hike. But once again, we are back with Russia, Trump, and the story that just won't go away.
Well, we just saw another story on Monday, which now feels like, you know, a month ago. another report that Donald Trump had basically asked some senior intelligence officials to put the clamps down again on the FBI investigation of Russia. I mean, that was this week. It doesn't feel like it.
Well, you knew the John Brennan testimony this week,
too. Right.
I mean, how many more
of these
guys?
A month and a half ago.
And Flynn took the fifth. I mean, you knew that was going to happen. And so it all looks guilty. There's something going on. It's why? And if there was any type of collusion or anything in terms of rigging to the... This is why Hillary Clinton's out now. Have you noticed that she's come out of the woodwork and she's speaking
out? Well, we'll talk about that. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Why don't we get to the overreported and underreported stories that happened this week here on The Download. Stay with us. All right, so Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. 773 says... The whole Russia story just makes me sick. 219 says, we the people don't believe anything that news media says, making up stories so they can get ratings, fake news. There you go. So we're seeing a contrast in the text tonight. Jeff Cohen and Lauren Cohen in studio as we break down this week's news. So we went up through the biggest story. And like I said, Manchester was definitely our choice. And also some other big stories. So many big stories this week. But obviously the Jared Kushner story that just broke, the Washington Post sort of trumped it. Let's talk about, overreported and underreported. Jeff, your overreported story is one that was all week long, and it was the first overseas trip for President Trump.
Yeah, that was one of mine. And I mean, obviously there's going to be reporting on the president's first overseas trip, especially when Trump really hasn't traveled very much at all. I mean, even west of the Mississippi, right. I think you can maybe count on your hand, but, Yeah, basically, I think that could be a Twitter problem too. I mean, we get so much of our news these days from social media, obviously, but just every little, I mean, Milani won't hold his hand and mm-hmm. he's pushing a guy out of the way and, you know, the weird.
That was a great moment.
Like the weird sort of Adams family yeah. photo with the Pope. Yeah. And it just felt like after a while, it's like every 5 seconds, I felt like I was just seeing another weird thing versus anybody really talking about whatever policy.
Well, and. I agree. I have to say, I mean, there was so much, there was just so much reporting that was about how he was relating or reacting or in the moment with world leaders. It wasn't necessarily about what they were talking about or what the policies were that was coming up beyond. I mean, last week was the Saudi Arabia speech at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, that was like, I think that was over the weekend where it started. And that was the rest of it has been when he was in Israel and he said, we just got back from the Middle East. And yeah, he's the ambassador on the and he grabs his head. And then he realizes he's on tape and he's like, I'm going to rub my hair. Yeah. I thought a very strange and head scratching moment at NATO where the speech was, I really don't like NATO to NATO. I mean,
I don't like Germany to Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought the funny one was when he pushed aside the leader, that other leader, and
yeah.
pushed in front for the photo op. But then if you looked at the aerials, he was walking through the crowd of dignitaries and looking up and waving more than anybody else was, like he was some rock star, like he was Sting in the crowd and everybody was suddenly like there to see him. But there's no context in what he does and what he says. So regardless of your politics and what you think of the president, I don't feel like there was so much for reporters to even report on because he doesn't have any information or context when he visits this country. It's all a photo op.
It was much more about the circus, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the other thing is leaders of other countries and their reactions to him. And we haven't really seen a lot of that in person, you know, on their home turf. So I guess that part of it was interesting. But
the other overreported story you had, which I want to bring up so we can get to the underreported stories Lauren has as well. The census, the population story, I agree. This is a local story, and it's about how Chicago is shrinking, and there's all this. And now that comes out, the U-Haul comes back, says a lot of people are using our trucks to move to Chicago. I mean, it's a goofy story.
I just felt that most of the time it was reported without context, and we've been dealing with a situation here for a number of years where, you know, you hear the term tale of two cities, and I think that's probably what we have here. We have in the last official census of 2010, we learned that some 200,000 African Americans had left Chicago and the Chicago area, and immigration from, you know, Mexico and some other things that kind of offset that. The other thing that's offset it is sort of the kind of the global city we see growing around us downtown. We have cranes everywhere. We have, you know, McDonald's headquarters coming to the West Loop. You've got a lot of young kids just out of college coming here. And so it almost is it's a balance. I mean, to talk about several thousand mm-hmm. people even being down, you don't really have the kind of the back and forth of what's really going on here. You have some of the lower income impoverished areas that are dealing with crime and a lot of social problems. They're really emptying out, and you're kind of getting a swap for, you know, younger, non-minority, wealthier Chicagoans. And I just felt like it was just, oh, look, Chicago's turning into Detroit. Well, no, it isn't.
Well, I mean, it seems like whenever there's any sort of shift, even if it's hundreds instead of thousands of people that leave Chicago, it seems to become a story that makes it in the headlines and in our Twitter feeds and other places. Why do you think that is? I mean, there seems to be almost a schadenfreude at work here where people want to see the city fail. And if people are leaving, it confirms that.
Because people need something to complain about. And in this case, the massive migration out is related to the fact that it's becoming unaffordable to live.
That's
the whole property
true.
Tax issue that everybody's freaking out about. And it's become a bigger narrative because of the budget impasse and what's going on. And whether they're liberal or conservative talking points or Republican or Democratic talking points, you know, you're going to see these headlines about all these people are leaving because you can't afford your home anymore. We're going to go talk about health insurance, or the cost of living has gone up. The median household income is $57,000, you know, dollars. That hasn't changed since 2007. Mm-hmm. So you might see more high rises going up in downtown, and certain, you know, millennials may or may not be able to afford them. But you still have people leaving because our neighbors have better offers for manufacturing.
And we still became a target. I mean, not to keep going back to Trump, but he dragged Chicago into the spotlight repeatedly a few months ago, you know, dealing with the violence issue and whatnot. So I think there's still a lot of energy toward anything negative in Chicago kind of is blown back to the Obama situation.
Yeah, and I mean, as much as there's optics are a big part of this, and obviously bad tweets, things of that nature, there are a lot of problems in this town, and if you're on the fringe and you have the ability to leave, I can understand why people might want to jet.
I have friends that have left because of that reason. They're just like, it's too much already. Are there opportunities? Maybe there are some in certain sectors, like we've built our tech community up. But in other areas where you may not have the skill set, or you're a company, I mean, I did a piece for PBS on all these manufacturing companies that said, you know what, we're going to move, you know, right from East Chicago over to Indiana, where we don't have to move that far because it's a better deal for us. Mm-hmm. And it's more affordable to live there.
And if you're in one of these communities where you can't walk to the corner store without hearing gunshots and worrying about where your kid is, then, you know, I'd leave too the second I could. And I think that, you know, people use that to reflect badly on the mayor, you know, and that's probably a natural.
Jeff Cohen, Lauren Cohn, in studio tonight as we reload this week's news. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news from Rob. We come back underreported. Great start. Thinking of all the news that's happened this week, we haven't even got to Springfield with what's happening with the last week of what might be a balanced budget. We'll see. We haven't talked at all about the healthcare situation, the vote and the Congressional Budget Office. We haven't even talked about the Montana guy who slammed the reporter yet. There's a lot going on.
We're going to need maybe 3 hours.
We're going to need a couple more hours here as we reload the news here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Excited to have my panel in studio tonight, Lauren Cohn. She's a radio TV personality. She hosts In Loop at WYCC, co-hosts that show. Jeff Cohen, of course, investigative reporter, Chicago Tribune. You read his byline every year and a half or so. You know,
he's always on you're being a little optimistic there.
All right, let's keep going. Underreported.
I read what you write.
Yeah, underreported. So we did overreported. Underreported. I have to say, Lauren, you're underreported. Just hit it right on the head. The idea of the Congressional Budget Office brings out the numbers on what this new health care bill is going to cost American taxpayers, and 23 million people are going to get bounced off insurance in 10 years. And it just kind of, it was a headline for a minute, but there was a lot more to what the CBO was saying, and we just, no one grabbed it.
There's so much to this story. I mean, the headline was, oh, 23 million people are going to lose their insurance. I'm not sure that the CBO numbers are correct, because they originally said that, you know, double the amount of people were going to sign up for Obamacare, and they didn't.
Right.
So, but even if it is correct, and that's the headline, and you feel empathetic towards those people who had access to health insurance, there's so many layers to the story that we forget. We forget to go back to the fact that there were so many taxpayers, people who had health insurance plans that they liked, doctors that they liked, that they lost. They lost their doctors, cancer patients who then were facing mortgage-style payments for health care. So, on top of this, nobody's talking about the exchanges. You know, they can go back and forth between the House and the Senate all summer into the, you know, the fall over what to do and pick apart now Trump Care.
Right.
But it really doesn't matter because insurers are setting the rate for June, and they're going to set that could get extended to August. So whatever's going to be set for 2018 is going to be a lot of money out of everybody's pocket.
The problem I have with everything that you said, which is spot on, is that this bill doesn't change any of that. For all the things that happened and that the Republicans wanted to fix with the bill when there was criticism to the Obama plan, you getting bumped off your plan, doctors, all that kind of stuff, that's not even really touched in this, and it's going to continue. And what you find more often now is just, I think the CBO said, a predicted 20% increase in premiums for everybody. Not just for people who are on the exchanges, but for everybody. For me at my work, other places, you know, the idea that healthcare insurance is going to go up. I'm just fascinated on how that story became political.
It's
in the way that
too.
CBO is like, the Republicans throw it out because of its bad track record when it comes to predictions.
But in a week like we're talking about, it's just bizarre that the eighth or ninth Trump story is the fact that he's leaning toward basically sabotaging the existing system.
Yeah.
And defunding. I mean, that's completely lost in the shuffle beyond, you know, Russia and everything else and the Pope and whatnot.
Well, and you go back to the fact that, okay, so what in terms of what the Republicans like in the plans, they like the tax incentives. They want to stop the mandate. They don't want you to be forced to buy health care. So there are things in there. What they're doing is they're picking this apart financially, basically, Justin, because they don't know how to pick this thing apart. You know, they ran on repeal and replace because it was unpopular for their base, and it's unpopular for a lot of people. I've never been a fan of it because if you're going to roll out something like that, you better have a plan to pay for it, and you can't just put the burden on taxpayers to foot the bill for other folks if they're going to then lose their health insurance. It's if you're going to redistribute wealth, there has to be a better system. And some people thought, you know, President Obama was teeing us up for single payer. I don't personally think that the government should be in the business of healthcare because they didn't do a very good job.
No.
But what the Republicans are doing right now is they're sort of trying to pick this apart because they don't know what to do.
They don't really have anywhere to go. And I think, I mean, even Boehner today, I think, came out and said it's pretty much dead as far as he's concerned in the Senate.
Well, I'm concerned only because I think about this a lot. And we've had conversations even on the download this week about other areas where the federal government has been accused of overreaching. And we talked about it with the Fraternal Order of Police president. We talked about it with Laura Kipnis about sexual assaults on campuses. There seemed to be a thread that the government may have in their best interest, to the best interest of Americans and American taxpayers, you know, having universal health care. It might be that. But the way that they implement it, and it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat or who's in charge, implementing a federal program, almost they always get it wrong. There's something about that it's just not, and there's something to be said, and I know that this, that and I don't think it's articulated very well for President Trump, but I think that's what he means when he said the federal government shouldn't be in this and shouldn't be in that. That's what he's saying. It's like, it's too big, it's too unwieldy, it's not actually going to work for people. Just get out of that game.
Right, and that's why he's saying too many moving parts. Like, you know, leave Medicare alone, leave Social Security alone, and then kick it back to the states. So let the states try and handle this. Let them handle, you know, if those that expanded Medicaid, and that's become a real issue. That's another thing that sort of gets buried is the whole weeds of Medicaid. And it was originally set up to help the people that need it the most. Now there are all these layers of people getting Medicaid, as opposed to the conversation of these people need to be getting jobs to be out there and be working and to be able to afford health care. The other thing that nobody talks about is whatever happened to the idea of competition and free market, right? Insurers are in the business of giving you skinny light at the most amount of money. But if you have a system where there's choice, where there's competition, you drive prices down.
Yeah, but we'd had that, though. We had that 8 years ago before Obamacare came in, the idea that we relied on the free market and competition to drive insurances. And we saw egregious, just draconian and inhumane things happening in the free market. So there was a reason why the government came in to say, we have to have federal universal health care for all because the insurance companies are run amok. So there's I understand why they would do it. I question at the end of the day what we're doing now that's different than what was done 5 years ago, 8 years ago, or whatever, you know, when you talk about federal health care.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's one of the most difficult issues going right now. And I've been fortunate enough to have a fairly long Tribune career, and I've had good health insurance pretty much throughout. And I kind of agree with you. I'm kind of afraid of a system going back to where, you know, the insurance companies really are running.
Let me ask you this, Lauren. I because you said it too, this idea that pushing it back to the states. And this has been something that has been a big, big part of the Trump administration's push to how he wants to run the federal government. And he ran on this concept, too, to take the federal government's hands out of a lot and put it back to the states. But we live in a state where we don't have a balanced budget. We don't have any disposable income there. I mean, there's no bank accounts. You know, it's like we don't have rainy day funds. So if you're pushing back to the states a Medicaid expansion or any sort of social service cuts or social service agencies or any sort of help, we're going to continue to the state's going to say no, we're not going to do that because we can't afford it.
Well, then it's up to the governors, and the governors are going to decide whether Republicans or Democrats. So you might see something here in this state, you know, the whole idea of, okay, well, if we're going to be a state, we're going to opt out of the exchanges. We're going to, you know, Governor Rauner wants to completely revamp Medicaid. Here's what's interesting about the exchanges. You two have kept your health care. I've experienced losing my health care and then having to, okay, as an individual, you have to go to the exchange. You can't go directly to, let's say, an Aetna or Blue Cross Blue Shield. So when you go to the exchanges, what happened here in Illinois, which has happened across the country, is you had a number of of PPOs and HMOs in the exchanges. And we'd read the headlines in the Tribune all the time. Mm-hmm. Okay, Northwestern's dropping out. Now Blue Cross Blue Shield is dropping out with the Northwestern plan. Now let's go to Land of Lincoln. But they didn't make it. So we'll kick everybody to Harkin. Now Harkin's out, right? So we kept seeing that. Currently now in the exchange in Illinois, you have HMOs and you have one PPO, Blue Cross Blue Shield, but a lot of doctors at Northwestern and other places aren't in it.
It's ridiculous.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
So what do you do? So then when I went to the exchange, it was more expensive than COBRA. And by the way, COBRA, which is an extension of your health insurance for 18 months, if folks out there don't know what it is, it's very expensive. So I now saw my monthly payment go up sixfold.
Yeah, that's not how it's supposed to go, right?
Right, and then a higher deductible, and it's a mortgage payment.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. Everything that you said is the reason why Obamacare is failing and has failed. Now, the question I have for you, as someone who's on it, do you blame the federal government? Do you blame the insurance companies who have decided that they're going to opt out because it's not worth, they're not making enough money on those plans? I mean, that's where it starts to get weird for me, where I'm like, well, the system is designed for the healthcare companies or the insurance companies to come in and say, all right, we'll do this. And at some point or another, they said, we're not making enough money on this deal, so we're going to bounce out. And once they bounced out, then you started to see some of the problems you were just talking about.
Well, so I don't believe in government handouts. So from my own perspective, working as a hardworking person and I pay taxes, I want to be out there and I want to have choice. So I don't want to be told I have to go to the exchange. I don't necessarily want to be told either if I'm going to get the opportunity, hopefully, to go to a Blue Cross Blue Shield or an Aetna or a Cigna, to be told if I have a pre-existing condition, which I do, I have a thyroid condition, suddenly you can't be on it. So this is new for me, and it's going to be really interesting. But I believe that I should be able to shop around, find the best plan for me. And by the way, insurers are going to offer skinny light for the most amount of money because they can, because there's nothing to drive them, their costs down. In terms of, you know, I would rather that than deal with the government personally.
Lauren Cohn, Jeff Cohen in studio. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do winners and losers. It's a download. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Mike on the line. Mike, what do you want to say about insurance companies?
Hey, I just want to hear more about your comment that talked about how draconian and I forget the other adjective you used, that insurance companies were pre-Obamacare. And that just really kind of catches me off guard. I really think that the insurance companies are part of the solution, not part of the
Mike,
problem.
What I mean, but and the reason there was a federal a mandate, if you will, I mean, to bring universal health care to America was because there were thoughts that the private insurance market, everything that was happening before 2008, was run amok. You don't agree with that?
I do not.
Okay.
I actually 100% disagree with it. That's what the people said, or the politicians said. The problem is that healthcare and the cost of healthcare, meaning inflation in healthcare, is way out of control.
Yeah.
And that's not the insurance companies. That has nothing to do with the insurance companies. That has to do with doctors, hospitals, pharmacies, labs. The insurance companies are like two pennies in the overall scheme of things. So I actually find it sort of irresponsible journalism for you to say that.
Thank you for calling me a journalist. I appreciate it.
I don't know. Well, you, whatever. I like your show sincerely, and I like your comments. But like, tell me the bad things they did.
Well, can I just make a point? And that is what's interesting, Mike. In terms of what Mike is bringing up is that in terms of the rates of doctors and the rates of big pharma, those are things that do need to be renegotiated. You shouldn't be able to, you know, have a $20,000 procedure in Alabama and it'd be $40,000 here. So there is a lot of discrepancies in terms of rates, but there's also for doctors reimbursements that they're not getting. There's also, you know, when you go in to a hospital, or you go in for your annual checkup, do you actually ask the question when the doctor says, I'm going to do your blood work, what are you doing and how much does it cost at the lab?
Right. You don't ever.
And now you have to, because when you get that bill, there's got to be a new education of what your doctor's asking and suggesting that you get. But also you have to be vigilant as a consumer to not rack up all these costs when you go for unnecessary treatments.
And it's never been in the consumer's interest, or it's never been told to a consumer to to monitor the things that are happening with your doctor prescribes.
And I also think what he's sort of referring to in terms of insurance is, I think when Obamacare was rolled out, it was really a redistribution of wealth. And I think that that's why the whole idea was really teeing it up for single payer. I think that this is sort of what President Obama did for 8 years, and he really wanted to redistribute the wealth in this country. But what happened was there were not enough people that signed up for Obamacare, and it then became, you know, too expensive for the government, for the taxpayers to subsidize, and the insurers had a caveat in there that if this starts to implode, you still have to give us money, which is what's being argued in court right now. And they just got the 90-day extension that the federal government still has to keep giving the insurance companies a portion of that money.
Well, I don't necessarily agree that it was a redistribution of wealth. I mean, I think that the idea that we wanted federal health care, universal health care, was something that was ran on by the politicians in that campaign. The idea that it's high time for do that. I understand what Mike's saying about just kind of throwing out generalities, and I understand that. But there was a fervor in 2007, 2008, where people were like, this is going to be the time. I mean, Mitt Romney in Massachusetts was doing it as a governor. It was not a partisan thing. There's this idea that government should be involved in healthcare, and that's what happened. I'm not sure how much it was all about Obama.
And your word partisan there, I think, is one that's well taken, because I think the American people are pretty well fed up at this point and want these guys to get together and actually compromise.
And by the way, none of them had to take Obamacare, right? None of them. Everyone.
They fixed that. Yeah, right. But this
should be something where we sit down and actually fix this problem.
Yeah, right.
This should not be
political
and counting. And
I think
you're going to
have a tsunami and an implosion before it ever gets to that level.
Well, I mean, I'm holding an article right here out of North Carolina where now there's only Blue Cross and Blue Shield left down there in, as far as in the exchange there.
And it gets political, and it gets in this strange moment where you hear the president, you know, sort of hinting at the idea that he wants to kill, he wants to almost kill the exchanges and end this so that the government, the House and the Senate have to act.
Yeah, I don't think this is one where you can force the issue by doing that to bring people to the table, because it's just not going to work. So it would be a shame to really roll a hand grenade, you know, into the healthcare system to force some kind of a deal.
And by the way, another reason why the CBO numbers may not be correct is the fact that a lot of people were forced to get health care because of the mandate. And so people, you know, may not want to pay that. And therefore, you're going to see those numbers change. That's another underreporting.
Yeah. All right. Let's do winners and losers. Jeff, what do you got for winners this week?
Well, I was going to do the mayor of New Orleans and his speech on the removal of Confederate monuments. I think that was a speech that was widely shared. A lot of people were interested in that. I was going to say the Pope. I think, you know, everybody loves the Pope. I'm going to go with journalism, though. I think, especially with at the top of the show here, we started talking about the Washington Post and New York Times. I mean, it's turned into a new golden age for journalism, and a lot of papers are seeing their numbers go up as people are trying to keep pace with all this stuff, and I just think it's really interesting.
And you saw even locally some places saying they're going to double their production locally, so there's a lot that's happening. Sure. What do you got for winners, Lauren?
So winners were the insurance companies, and losers were everybody else. And then when it comes to the Illinois tax hike, which I know we're going to talk about, of course the winner to me is Speaker Madigan and his what I call his posse, and the losers are, again, everybody else.
It's interesting. I mean, and I know that Speaker Madigan is the leader of the Democratic Party, and I get it. But he hasn't even touched this yet. I mean, this was Senator Cullerton. This was the Senate. The idea that Mike Madigan's name is stamped on it before the bill even gets to the House.
He's the boss of Illinois.
I understand,
everything.
I get it, but it just...
He sent us off the fiscal cliff.
I just feel like sometimes the idea of Madigan controlling the strings, I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to have plenty of time this weekend that we see Mike Madigan and Mike Madigan being up in front when he makes little tweaks to the bills that will end up on Rauner's desk. But so far, I'm not sure Mike Madigan has any play with Christine Redonio and Senator Cullerton in the other chamber. But maybe I'm naive.
They're little puppets. He's pulling the strings. That's I know that's a Cassieism, and if John Cass is out there listening, he knows that when I saw this tax story, I said, is the Hobbit hole ready for me to build on your property? Because that's where I'm headed.
I mean, it is it's too big for us to get into right before the news, and we'll do it right after, but a huge week when it comes to what might we see with a balanced budget and a tax increase, a huge tax increase in the state of Illinois, one that is not just sort of like, well, all right. I mean, some have estimated that, because it would be retroactive to January 1st, that could be hundreds of dollars a month more than it was So there's, I mean, this this is all to cover a budget hole and bills that have been stacking up and piling up here in the state of Illinois for the last couple of weeks. So we'll talk, let's do this. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll do losers, because I think that's really where we can get into who are the losers when it comes to tax hikes and other things. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Lauren Cohn, radio TV personality here in town and the co-host of In the Loop on WYCC. Great show. Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Great paper. I love what you both do. Okay. Get that out of the way. We did winners. Let's do losers. We got losers. We got rabbit hole. And we got which story is going to be remembered in 10, 15, 50, 500 years from now. Let's do losers. I mean, I guess, Jeff, we got to start with the Montana congressman. I mean, that's such a story.
Yeah, here we go. I mean, we're way more than an hour in and a journalist getting body slammed. We're just getting to it, so that's interesting.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, how about that? And then he wins anyway. I mean, that says a lot about sort of our...
Does it? I mean, I was wondering. A friend of mine had a Facebook post, and he really eloquently put it down. He said, if you are a Republican in Montana and you are upset with the way that a Republican candidate body slammed a reporter, you're not going to vote for a D. R does not equal D, and D does not equal R. That's the country we live in. We saw that with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You're just not. I mean, so exactly many people, right. Republicans said, I don't really like Donald Trump, but there's no other choice. The same kind of concept here. I think that you're not seeing a political landscape where the alternative in a two-party system is okay for the voter. They're not going to cross parties.
Well, when Speaker Ryan was asked about this, he just said, well, you know, the voters made the decision. He didn't even want to touch it.
No.
And in this case, I mean, you know, he apologized. You know, he gave the big apology, which a lot of them don't necessarily do. He gave an apology.
After the original statement, right. They made it sound like there was a little bit of a wrestling match and they both fell over or something.
Yeah.
As opposed to body slamming, right, punching the guy, breaking his glasses.
As opposed to grabbing him by the neck and throwing him down and then punching him.
And not a good moment for, as we continue to see American politics sort of slide further and further down, this just got the slide greased up.
Didn't you even say that some of the Fox News reporters were afraid at that moment?
Well, there was a Fox News crew that was in the room, and that's when the dam sort of broke on it, is when they were out saying that they saw more of a body slamming incident. That's when, you know, finally the thing.
I'm surprised people didn't have their cell phones up and everybody was taking video.
It was a closed door kind of thing, right? They were setting up, like the Fox News people were setting up and they were going to interview him, and a reporter came up to him, and it all happened with only like four or five people.
And he was asking about the CBO numbers, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, right. I mean, that's the other thing is the story that he had reported previously was this candidate's investment ties to Russia. So right back to one.
All right, let's go local here. I mean, that of course is a big loser story of the week for all of us. But the other story that Lauren, you have on losers is the tax hike and what's happening in Springfield as the lawmakers here in this state try to balance a budget for the first time in 700 days.
Yeah, I mean, Speaker Madigan's the winner. We're the losers in all of this. This, to me, is outrageous what's going on. I mean, this is tax our way out of our problems, Illinois. You know, this is all that we know how to do. So now we're going to tax the air that we breathe. I mean, what isn't being taxed? I mean, I purposely protest the 7-cent bag tax, or what, that's for paper bags. Maybe it's more for plastic, out of principle. It's just, it's outrageous to me that we have to go line by line and tax everything to find a way for a revenue source. It's practically criminal, in my opinion.
What are the alternatives at this point? You're talking 700 days without a budget. And people will tell you, and nonpartisan, bipartisan people will say that Illinois spending, when it comes to the size of the government for this state, it's not out of proportion. So we just don't bring enough money in. The job of revenue sources, of course, can be shared. The blame can be shared with the legislature, can be shared with the governor, who was a pro-business governor who came in. But at what point does it become irresponsible to not increase taxes?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about bringing in revenue sources, we want to bring in business, we have to change the tax code here to make it more business friendly. But you need pension reform. And here's the thing about pension reform. And, you know, I totally appreciate the fact that people that receive pensions want what was promised to them. But these were deals that were made between union bosses and politicians at a time when the economy was at a different level. And now the amount to pay into these pensions isn't sustainable. And by the way, you can't send the taxpayers below the poverty line to make these pension payments. We're talking about maybe 5% of the population versus 95% who are paying for it. And so the problem is that until you fix the math, because it's not sustainable for them either. The pensioners are not going to get it because the math doesn't add up. So you have to have pension reform. You have to have them come together. Governor Rauner successfully negotiated with close to a dozen unions, including the Teamsters. There's got to be something that can be done there.
Yeah, but the big ones, AFSCME and others, he's still out on. But I will say that, you know, and Jeff, I want to bring you in on this. I mean, this has been a political hot potato on what happens. And we talk about the politics of passing a tax hike. And we saw, I mean, that the thing I think for taxpayers to remember, too, is that there was this income tax was, we had a higher income tax and the governor let it freeze, or he let it expire back in when he took office. And then we've had 2 or 3 years of this fight over budgets and ideology. And we're back to the point where we could be in 3 days back to the same idea of having the same rate.
And to me, it goes back, too, to what you said about just the political environment. I mean, we don't have anything like sort of the old school statesmanship compromise. Rauner was sent down there to engage in trench warfare that looks just like this, and neither side's willing to give. And I know we talked on the break about, you know, sort of this last-minute attempt at a balanced budget and to get something to Rauner. But, you know, is that another political fake-out, you know, to force him to veto something that includes a balanced budget so that, you know, he's a weaker candidate?
Mike Madigan is
definitely playing chess.
This is sure. chess. This is political chess because there are four players in that, and there are more. But I would say in this scenario, you have Christine Redonio and Cullerton, John Cullerton in the Senate. John Cullerton steps up and says, "We're not going to do the grand bargain stuff. This has been a ruse. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to pass a tax hike." The Senate does that. It's now in Madigan's hand. We don't know what he's going to do with it. He's been tight-lipped. Does he pass it through to give it to Rauner? So Rauner has to make a decision of whether or not he accepts a tax hike and signs it and has a balanced budget or veto it, like Jeff said.
But the governor has said that he's willing to agree to some tax hikes for one thing on his so-called turnaround
property
agenda.
Tax, really,
give him one thing.
Right.
I mean, come on, guys. Give him one thing. I mean, this is what it's been going back and forth. Give at least term limits. You know, I asked him in an interview once. I sat down with him for 15 minutes at one of his manufacturing plants, and we aired this on PBS. What's the one thing if you could get? And it was term limits. And I think that's obviously a shot at, you know, Speaker Madigan, who's been there. But even when under Governor Quinn, when we had the tax hike going back to 2011, we still are went off the fiscal cliff. So you can't just keep raising taxes and thinking it's going to fix the problem.
Now, I understand that, but this time around, I mean, Rauner has a chance to claim victory here. In the way, it's a win for him. I put him in the winner category in the way that he could sign this and say, when I took over, government was this high. And I have, through the 2.5 years of stalemate, I brought its spending back into form. The size of government is smaller than it was. We are getting closer and closer to understand. I mean, the some of the things that were in the balanced budget, the 10% tax or 10% cuts at universities, 5% cuts at social service agencies, that would never have been done by Democrats if it wasn't for the pressure that Rauner put on.
Well, and how about him turning back to basically campaign-style ads to get his point across here? He's put the flannel shirt back on.
The duct tape?
Yeah.
The MacGyver look.
Right. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think that, you know, the jeopardy goes way up for him if they get this thing to his desk.
It is. And I just wonder, I don't know if I have the mental political capability to wonder what the machinations are happening right now of what the right call is for a speaker, a Democrat speaker and a Republican governor, because this is all about what happens in 2018. And you're right. The losers here are us. Because we've been losers for 700 days without a budget, and so many of our fellow taxpayers are feeling the pinch, and we're going to and several more, all of us are going to feel it if this gets through. But man, it's what a story!
You want to almost see a movement here in Illinois of people marching to Springfield and saying enough is enough. You know, we've had enough of this, and you need to come together. But Governor Rauner does hold the highest office; it's his responsibility to bring both sides together. And I support that he came in as a businessman, and he's trying. This is what he was elected to do, to bring the fiscal house in order. And I think that there needs to be a corrective in Springfield. So give him one thing that he wants, get this thing done, and let's move forward.
Yeah, it's so good. And it all happened here in the next 5 days. Right?
Yeah, it's Wednesday's the last day.
Because they can't, if they go past Wednesday, if it doesn't happen by Wednesday, you go to that supermajority, that two-thirds, 70 votes, 71 votes. They don't have it.
I think it's basically Wednesday or not.
I don't think it's going to happen because I don't think Speaker Madigan wants to. He has no reason to negotiate. He has no incentive. So I think it's just going to.
But I love this because it's like, if he lets it die, then the Republicans have and the commercials and everything that's going to come out and their campaign can be like, he's the one that did not want to have a balanced budget. I mean, I don't know what he does. It's a rock and a hard place for all of them. And it's, you know, the best politics happens at the last minute. So we'll see how this kind of plays out. Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen in studio right now. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the rabbit hole stories and we'll find out which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news. Lauren Cohen in studio, radio TV personality. Catch her, she's the co-host of In the Loop on WYCC. As I know, Channel 20. Does it even work back then anymore? Is it 20 still?
It's still 20.
Is it? I love it. Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Lauren just mentioned in the break, wow, it has been a very heavy week in review.
Yeah.
There's not been a lot of like, oh, that's a light story. Where's the man romper?
The dad that wore a Speedo when he ran into school to see the kid. Did you see that video? Yeah. And it was a flashback to everything our parents have ever done that has embarrassed us. This poor kid to designate it's the last day of summer. Dad has to run up in a Speedo, and he just was not the kind of guy who should be running in a Speedo.
I'm thankful I did not catch that.
You're right. It's nice to see some stuff on the internet that's not Trump-related. It's not gaffes and things like that, so that's always nice. All right, so let's talk about rabbit hole. Jeff, you've got a story that you were reading out of L.A. that caught your fancy.
Yeah, this is not really going to lighten the mood, but this is when I did catch kind of randomly. It ran in Newsweek, apparently, but I saw it online. By Alexander Nazarian is the reporter's name, and it's the art washing of America, the battle for the soul of Los Angeles against gentrification. And basically the point of the story tracks activists in L.A., East L.A., fighting art galleries coming into their neighborhood. They see that as sort of the knife point of gentrification and the start of the coffee shops and the bacon cocktails and all that stuff. And they think that if they fight the galleries that they'll be able to kind of, you know, keep this at bay. And it just reminded me of some of the things we've seen in Chicago neighborhoods, Humboldt Park and things, as people get priced out of Wicker Park and some of these other places, that's where they tend to go. So is the art gallery the bellwether? So I thought that was interesting.
And usually, I mean, we think of art gallery and you might have this hoity-toity kind of, even in Chicago and the River North or West Loop, but a lot of art galleries, they're not. They're artists from the community, they're local, that they open up a space and a storefront, and you don't necessarily automatically think that to be a precursor to gentrification.
You wouldn't, and even some of the art galleries that have come into these areas, at least in the story, really did highlight people in the local community, but for whatever reason, the activists have seized on this. I just thought it was interesting, and it led me to reading about Dodger Stadium and how this is kind of history repeating itself. I didn't realize that Chavez Ravine actually had been a Mexican neighborhood that was kind of emptied out, and there were hills leveled up there to get the stadium in. It was sort of the definition of a rabbit hole for me. It was like 2 hours later.
That's interesting.
It's like the fear of the hoity-toity, and it can't just be, it would create business and opportunity for those. It's this, when people are so tight in their community and live in one way and not open to others, it's kind of amazing to think of that in 2017.
But you understand too, like if you're looking for a knife point of gentrification that it used to, I know that. I mean, Wicker Park, it was the guitar players, the street performers, even where you're like, oh, this is, and it was art galleries. It's art galleries where you're like, oh, this is cute. This brings so much life to the neighborhood.
Yeah. They make the point of if you wait for the Starbucks to appear, you've lost, you're already, the battle's over at that point.
And at the same time, you see it on the other hand, where you're like, an art gallery can be a center point for a community. It can be a place that showcases the artists and the work that's being done in a certain neighborhood without changing its feel.
Yeah, they'd rather keep it the way it is and not get priced out.
Yeah. Love it. All right. That's a good rabbit. Where is that at? Newsweek?
Newsweek, the art washing of America.
I'm going to check that out. All right, so let's do this, guys. You guys ready for the end here?
Absolutely.
Which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week. Lauren, what do we think is going to be the story?
The top story is going to be Manchester. It has to be. I mean, it rocked everybody to the core. It was just a horrific scene. And to see it in this case, you know, the bomb going off right outside the Ariana Grande concert with children, you know, mothers standing there with their children. 22 people were killed. I think 10 of those were children, you know. Just heartbreaking. And it resurfaces, obviously, the story of terrorism and what you need to watch out for. You know, the conversation of how vigilant do we need to be, that, you know, after 9/11, it was the first on American soil, then the Boston bombing. We're seeing this now all over Europe. That brings up the conversation again of, you know, visas. If someone's going to travel back and forth, they are born in the UK, but they're going to travel back to Libya or other countries. Do we let them back in? Raises that whole conversation.
Yeah, it does get back into immigration and everything. As ISIS splinters and we do sort of defeat them in terms of their land area space they occupy, where do those fighters go? And, you know, more and more we're seeing them kind of try to reintegrate back into Europe. Yeah. And
I thought really interesting story about that the mosque in Manchester had reported this guy.
Mm-hmm, right.
And told everybody, authorities, government authorities, police, everything, and nothing was done. So I think that also brings up the question of what is being done by governments and our police forces to make sure that some of the, when communities are reporting that they have an issue, that it's being taken care of. That's interesting.
When you talk to Homeland Security directors here, you know, whether it's Cook County or whether it's, you know, statewide, you know, national, they'll tell you about all the stories of thwarting these types of attacks. Yeah. Everything has gotten a lot better since 9/11, but you can't stop lone wolves. You can't, you know, if people are, you know, radicalized by ISIS via email, you can't stop it.
Well, that's the thing here, too, is that so many, ISIS realized sort of that the cards were against them. And so a lot of these training videos have just sort of seeped out. I mean, how to make a bomb, go to Walmart and buy enough, you know, buy things to make a bomb. And then, like you said, one lone wolf who's got an ideological string that goes awry, next thing you know, you've got one of these.
And it reminds these governments and different bodies that they have to share information, you know, that if you have somebody on a watch list, that you should share that, if UK with the United States. Governments have to work better together.
The other story this week was much different and much lighter, and Lauren, you had it in his mind as well, was the passing of the torch, if you will, as LeBron James beat Michael Jordan when it came to points scored in the playoffs. And as we get ready with a very long amount, a lot of time before the NBA finals start, they start on next Thursday, June 1st. The idea that LeBron James and Michael Jordan, is there a changing of the guard?
Well, I think in LeBron James's, this is what he's been rooting for, and Michael Jordan's his idol, but he, you know, was so excited, some would say, or arrogant, was running down the court with his index finger in the air as number one. I mean, it's almost like this is what he's wanted all along, and he got it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of the nature of the NBA, too. I think more than any other sport, it's about the individual athlete. I mean, you don't really see it. I mean, you've got the Tom Brady's and whatnot, but the NBA is sort of maximized. And you have the greatest player who's ever played is Michael Jordan. You have somebody who's finally reaching some of these levels. I think it's natural. And I think it was Bernie Linscombe's column today or yesterday talking about, you know, yes, LeBron is back, you know, facing the Warriors again, but really he's playing Michael Jordan. And that's true.
Yeah. Talk about the pressure.
Yeah.
Guys, not only got to have to play the four all-world players on the Golden State Warriors, but he's also got to play Michael Jordan, too.
Right.
Lauren Cohen, Jeff Cohen, you guys, great job reloading
great
this week's news.
Here.
It was awesome to have you, and I can't wait to have you again. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Coming up at the 10 o'clock hour, Trevor Sensor is going to be back. The singer-songwriter's got a new album coming out. He was just in town, Shubas. He will be performing tonight. Excited to have him back. Kid's growing up right in front of us. You know, he's got all sorts of great features on him and all the national sites. So it's really great. Because we had him on a year ago, probably almost to the day. And he was just kind of starting out. He had an EP. He's great. He's got such a unique sound. And now he's on his way. So good for him. I feel like, you know, we're family. You know, he's from Sterling, Illinois. I understand Sterling. All right, so this is an important night for us because this is a night in which we are christening a new segment. We have not named it yet. It's either The Reality or Reality Check. And what it is a couple months ago, we had talked with Tracy Swartz, the ink columnist over at Chicago Tribune, about reality television. And I just had more interest and curiosity because I haven't had a chance with this job, but also with interest and tastes and likes. I have not really paid attention as much as I should to reality television, specifically some of the things that we see, the dating contests like The Bachelor or Bachelorette and some of the other shows. So we got to talking that there's always a Chicago presence, and not just the contestants that are on the show, but some of the shows are actually set here. What is it, Marriage at First Sight?
Married at First Sight.
Married at First Sight, which is a show that's set here that's on Lifetime. So a lot to talk about, and this summer will not disappoint. Tracy Swartz, of course, the ink columnist over at Chicago Tribune. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
In studio. This is a pleasure. All right, so of course, All Eyes is a great week to start it because All Eyes this week were on the premiere of The Bachelorette. The Bachelorette, is it the first time it's an African-American contestant or woman who's at the center of it?
Yes, first African-American lead.
First African-American lead. So The Bachelorette started this week. Any changes besides that? I mean, is it pretty much straightforward? It's just another episode or another series of dating and with roses and stuff like that?
Yeah, except this season there was 31 contestants. 31. It is difficult to keep them straight.
How many are there usually?
Sometimes it's like 20, 25. 31 is the most I've seen, and I've covered the last seven iterations of this franchise.
All right, so let's talk specifically about the Chicago contestants. There were three, and then there's a fourth because there's a guy who used to live here, right?
No, there's four from Chicago, and then a fifth, a guy who used to live here.
Okay, right, the trainer.
Right, personal trainer. They're all personal trainers, by the way.
Is that a prereq to be on The Bachelorette? You got to be a personal trainer?
I definitely try to find new ways to describe them as personal trainers. Like, are there different adjectives to use besides the phrase personal trainer?
Now, what I know about The Bachelor and Bachelorette, and this is something that I, you know, from the little that I have watched, is that they're kind of lifer contestants.
Okay.
Meaning they were on The Bachelor, then they were on The Bachelorette, then they're on The Bachelor. Maybe they're on different shows as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this is almost like a job. This is a career for some of these guys.
Yeah, the guy who was just on Dancing with the Stars, Nick Vile, he started as a software salesman in Chicago, did two turns on The Bachelorette, runner-up both times, dumped both times on the finale. Then he went to Bachelor in Paradise. Then he became The Bachelor. Then he did Dancing with the Stars. I'm like this guy's personal biographer at this point.
I mean, but you see more and more of that. How much do you recognize the contestants of the 31? I mean, do you recognize any of them as being guests and contestants on other shows?
I think there were a couple who were on some short-lived, like smaller reality shows. But normally when you see them as contestants, they come on as nobody's, and then they use that as a launching pad.
All right, so let's talk about the Chicago contestants.
Okay.
There are, like you said, four, possibly five, if we count the guy. Who are these guys?
Okay, so we started with four, and then one guy got kicked off this week.
On the first week.
He had what was a pretty terrible introduction. So if you've never seen The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, first of all, congratulations. You saved yourself a ton of time. But essentially, whoever is that person stands there, and then everybody comes through a limo and does this introduction.
Hey, I'm Justin.
Right.
What's up? I like horseback riding. You look real pretty. That kind of thing, right?
No, but you would get kicked off because you have to go above and beyond to stand out because there's 31 guys.
Also, it's like a first impression.
So if you love horseback riding, you would come in on a horse and like you would do, you know, something. You would say some corny like horse joke,
right.
And then that would be your introduction.
And then forever, for the rest of the show, they'd be like, horse guy.
Like you would like come galloping in. You'd be like, I'm, you know, I got here just in time. And like, that's how she would remember you, to give you a rose at the ceremony.
And so over time, you have to do this. Like this has become almost like a cliche on the show. If you don't do it, you're out.
You're out. I mean, and so everybody talked about this guy this week. He had a catchphrase. He actually had a catchphrase that he put on a shirt and he wore it on the show. His catchphrase was Waboom. And this is the most annoying guy ever. He just, like, he doesn't just say, like, waboom. He, like, screams it and waboom, like, in your face. It's, like, very, like, annoying. And yet she still kept him around because, you know what? You remember that guy. You don't remember the guy who just comes in and says, hi, I'm Justin. I'm really looking forward to getting to know you. Here's a hug and walk away.
That doesn't work.
That doesn't work.
So what did the Chicago guys do?
So the guy who got kicked off, though, I must say, he was the one that stood out the most, but his line was not very good. His name is Michael. He's a former professional basketball player. He walked over to Rachel, handed her a brownie on a plate, and he said, the blacker the brownie, the sweeter the dude.
Doesn't even make sense. I understand what he's going for, but it's not even the right. Okay.
And then, so I don't think she took the pastry. Okay. She, because he kind of came back with it around. And because what happens is the guys go and they introduce themselves, and then they go to like kind of like a hangout area where they get drunk and then make bigger fools of themselves. So they can start.
So he did. He did that. It didn't work out.
It didn't work out.
He got bounced.
And he got bounced.
The other three guys, they're still around.
They're still around. So they did some intro videos this year before they even got to the introductions. So basically, ABC came to Chicago, and they filmed this one guy. His name is Kenneth, but he goes by Diggy because he said that he has a passion for fashion and that nickname stuck because people said they liked his digs. So they came to his place. He works for Groupon. Mm-hmm. And he showed off his sneaker collection, which he said was like 500 plus pairs.
Can I just stop right there? How many Chicago contestants work for Groupon? Like, I just feel like that's the go-to. My name's Trevor. I work at Groupon.
No, that's all personal trainers, my
friend. Personal trainers.
Personal trainers.
Personal trainers at Groupon? But they also, they train people at Groupon.
Maybe this guy, he's like an inventory guy. Maybe he checks the inventory for gyms and personal training. But I can tell you. Yeah, so he works at Groupon, and it was, so he came in and he did like, so they had him like show off a sneaker collection, and then he's shown like looking in the mirror, like giving himself like the finger guns in the mirror, and he's like, Diggy's got some swag. That was his intro.
Come on, I mean, I love your coverage of it because you can tell how much that you're, you know, enjoying it.
Yeah,
you're
enjoy it is one word.
That's
for
a
it.
One word for it. Do the Chicago, it's only been 1 week, but do the Chicago contestants on The Bachelorette, do they have a chance? Do they look like they're, any of them like jump out in front sort of as front runners early in this game?
So Diggy did okay, but I didn't even get to the other two. The other guy's name is Iggy. So it's Diggy and Iggy,
Diggy from Chicago right.
on the season. And Iggy was the first one to be called out. He owns his own like startup company here. Of the Chicago guys. So I think he made the top six or seven as far as like call out order. And then the third guy, he used to play football for Northwestern, and he works in like education software. And he was kind of forgettable. Like I definitely had to go through my notes and like sort of.
But he made it.
He made it. But she kicked off 8 people in the first episode.
Man.
So now we're down to 23, which is still way too many.
So will they do that again? Will there be like a 7 cut next week? Probably?
I think there'll be 4 that are cut next week. But the one guy that's doing really well is the guy who used to live in Chicago. He is from Wisconsin. He's a personal trainer.
Interesting.
And he used to live in Chicago. And in his brief time in Chicago, he was named one of Time Out Chicago's hottest trainers. Which was on, like, his Bachelorette resume.
Yeah. I guess you have to be a hot trainer to be in reality TV.
Yeah.
Because you can't just be
a personal trainer.
If you're a personal trainer but you're not hot, where are you going to go?
Yeah.
You're gonna kind of get skate, and then you're going to go down.
Yeah.
But if you're a hot personal trainer, sky's the limit, right?
Yeah.
Tracy Swartz in studio. She is the Ink columnist with the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about the Chicago contestants that are on reality television. In a new segment we're calling Reality, either
Something.
The Reality or Reality Check. One of two. Which one do you like, Pete? Pete will tell us like what he likes, and Mark Tier will tell us, too.
I like Reality Check.
Reality Check, right? It feels like it's already been used, though, right?
By whom?
Would I be the first person to be?
Probably not.
Yeah, right?
But you don't want to be original.
Yeah.
Wait, maybe you should think about how you want to introduce this segment as if you were introducing yourself to The Bachelorette.
Hey, I've got my own hashtag. I've got my own regular segment on my AM radio show. That could get it, right? That could get it.
No.
No?
No. You got to put it on your shirt.
I got to put the download reality check hashtag on the t-shirt.
And a picture of you on
and I have,
radio.
I need a catchphrase. A waboom! All right. Let's move on to some of the other shows, because there are other shows that are happening in the Chicago area or have Chicago contestants on it right now. They're in reality television, because ABC doesn't have the corner, does not corner the market when it comes to reality TV. There's a lot of cable that is doing reality still.
Yeah, although ABC, I mean, David Ross just went through. He made it to second place on Dancing with the Stars.
Was he Sanjaya, the guy from American
Idol?
Was he a Sanjaya? Like, I missed it. I missed all of the David Ross dancing. I never watched it. Was he kind of like, oh, he's so bad, he's good? Or was it because he's a Cubs guy and Anthony Rizzo and company were tweeting out and all the Cubs fans came out for him? Because he's not that great of a dancer. How'd he get to number two?
So Mr. T would be more of the Sanjaya because he was more like gimmicky. David Ross was just really like earnest and like very humble. So I think that helped him. And he was really like watching your dad dance like at a wedding. And you're like sitting there and you're like smiling because he's so goofy. And so I think the goofiness really like helped him. But also he did have a lot of celebrities tweeting out support for him. And he seemed like the everyman. But no, he was not the best dancer.
Yeah, because I mean, in some cases, there were some dancers who got bounced in the third, fourth, fifth round, that kind of thing, that were really good dancers.
I mean, he beat Simone Biles.
Right.
That's insane. I mean, she was a great dancer, gymnast, like America's Sweetheart at one time.
So, I mean, half of Dancing with the Stars, half of it is judge, half of it is call-in, vote. So you can understand why David Ross is popular, because he's a baseball player and people loved him. And if you love the Cubs, you're going to vote for Ross. You're actually going to go and call or go online and do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, but it's got to be some talent, though. I knew that he would not win just from watching the show. And the guy who won was also an athlete, but he was a really good dancer. Rashad Jennings, NFL running back.
You have to tell me. I play fantasy sports. He's a Giants running back.
Okay. Well, how did he do in your fantasy Dancing with the Stars league?
He didn't do well in either. He's not the greatest running back. And I did not have him in the fantasy Dancing with the Stars.
Who did you pick, Charo?
You know, the year before we did, I would have taken Catan. But the year before we did a thing here at the station, and I won. It was a gymnast, right? What was the gymnast who won last year?
Lori Hernandez.
Yeah. I had her. Me and Martyr had her. And we won. So there you go. So we know our way around Dancing with the Stars pools around the office. What are some of the other shows after Dancing with the Stars that have Chicagoans on it?
So you mentioned the Married at First Sight. And I don't know if you've seen the show. It started.
I have not.
Well, it started on the FYI network a couple of years ago. And essentially, it is what it says. It is six strangers are paired off, and they meet at the altar, and they get married right afterwards. And then they have 8 weeks to decide if they will stay together or get divorced. So each season, they do in different places, New York, Atlanta, South Florida. So they filmed last fall. This one is Chicago-based. Three couples got married at the Palmer House Hilton, and they're about halfway through airing this season. So right now they've found apartments together, and they have moved in, and they are sort of like meshing their lives to see if it's going to work out beyond the remaining 6 weeks.
There are some ethnicities in this world that still continue to do arranged marriages. Why not just follow those? Why fake it and create a thing down at the Palmer House Hilton?
I mean, so there were 40,000 people around the country who applied to be on this season.
Wow.
40,000 people were willing to marry a complete stranger. Not no pictures, didn't know their names, nothing. Literally, you saw them at the altar, and then you got married. A complete stranger.
Wow, that's crazy. That's a good idea for a show. All right, quickly, I have 224 says, ask Tracy what she thinks of the reality show First Dates.
Oh.
Set in Chicago, airing on Friday nights.
So I actually just wrote a story about this yesterday. So the season finale was tonight. Basically what it was kind of the same thing, but it was just dates. You didn't have to get married.
Sure. different levels.
They filmed it 2 years ago at MK Restaurants on the North Side. And I thought it was really interesting. Sort of how they paired people. And then what they did is at MK, it was one night and everybody in the restaurant was on a first date. Okay.
Okay.
Completely nerve-wracking. But so they talk to each couple or each person individually. You know, what are you looking for? They show them on the date. And then afterwards, they said, would you like a second date? And some of those responses were really interesting.
Well, it's like, yeah. You said there's a contestant on MasterChef.
Yep. We have a woman who is a nutritionist here, lives in Ukrainian Village. She was on last season. She made the top 40 but didn't make the first cut for the top 20. So she is coming back this season to compete, and that starts on Wednesday.
All right.
And normally we have a lot more contestants from the Chicago area on that one, but she's pretty much it this season.
And then the last thing is just the Amazing Race finale was...
The Amazing Race finale is next week. It's June 1st, and it was filmed at Wrigley Field and then at the park near Navy Pier. And that was filmed last July. Hmm. So I have not yet seen that episode to see, you know, but they're down to three couples competing in that.
I love it. All right. We now know who we have to follow, right? We have to who we're going to follow on The Bachelorette, who we're going to follow on... Arranged marriage, what's it called? Marriage at first sight?
Married at first sight.
Married at first sight.
It seems like you have an idea for a new
relationship. I know, I feel like I need to get in front of some of these reality producers. I have some ideas. Tracy Swartz is the Ink columnist over at Chicago Tribune. You can find her stuff there. She writes about not just reality TV, but entertainment here in Chicago. Tracy, thanks for being here. Thanks for the first hashtag reality check. Question mark?
Question mark. Thanks for getting me out from thanks for getting me away from my TV for the night.
There you go. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're back in studio tonight with us almost a year since his last visit. Singer-songwriter Trevor Sensor. He was here last year playing songs and talking about his first EP on Jag Jaguar Records. And now he's back in Chicago touring on his anticipated album, Andy Warhol's Dream, which is out in June. He was just in town at Shuba's. The record has some Chicago connections, including some guest spots from the guys from Whitney, who were on the show not too long ago, and producer credits from Richard Swift, who used to be in the Shins. Sensor, of course, from Sterling, Illinois. And he joins me in studio once again. How's it going, Trevor? Good to see you.
That's good to see you too, man.
Tom, let's talk about that. I mean, it's been a year. The show is somewhat new in the sense that it's only been 2 years, so we don't have a lot of repeat guests that come through. So it's awesome to be able to talk to you about, you know, what your last year has been like. When we talked last time, we were talking a lot about growing up in Sterling, but just, you know, the idea of getting out on tour. Let's talk more about that, the idea of how has the last year been for you musically?
Well, it's been interesting. I've been honestly on the road. I think when I talked to you last, the first time, I had just graduated college and I was like just going on the road.
Right.
And now I'm going on the road again. But there is a lot of road and then some downtime in between there. And it's been nice. I mean, I've been able to just kind of been putz along and play shows and work on this record and stuff. And it's not like what they say it is in the movies.
Really?
It's not super glamorous. No.
What? Tell us about it. Like, what's not glamorous about it? What's life like on tour?
Well, I mean, for the majority of it, I've been by myself. I just recently added a member to the live show. I'm trying to build around it. We'll see how that goes. So it's been just kind of me in a car a lot with vinyl and guitars and just driving across the country. I did like a 7-week tour with like Foy Vance in the fall. And that, like, almost made me half crazy because I was just out on the road by myself for 2 months, basically. But there's also, like, this weird amount of downtime in between tours and recording sessions and stuff,
right,
like, where I'm either staying at friends' places or my parents or something, and there's not much to do besides write and read and, you know, get your occasional cheap bottle of vodka, et cetera.
As a young musician, how much of the experience is reconciling about what you thought it was going to be? You know, like going out, when we talked to you, going out on the road and you sort of have a romantic idea of what that's going to be like, and you'd played clubs at that point, but how much of it is the thought of what it's the romance behind it and what it actually is?
I knew, like, going into it that it's not like one of those things where you just go out there and everybody loves you or something. I think the learning experiences I've had are about how to properly make a record. And some of that was going back to my roots and how I felt originally, and I got sidetracked from those. Also, just how to navigate the industry better, I think. There's definitely, like, this aspect where, you know, like, the cliche is true. If you make a lot of money, everybody's your friend. And if you're on the bottom rung, people will get to you when they get to you, in a sense. So even though you've been, like, welcomed into this into this party, right? You've been signed as an artist and everything, and that's like a big step in anybody's career as an artist or whatever to get in the party. It doesn't mean that all the other problems go away. Everything's still there. You've just accomplished getting everybody's name. It doesn't mean that they actually like deeply care about you yet or anything.
Well, I think about, you know, even the last time you were on, I mean, I think we were emailing with you to have you on. You know, this time around, there's more people involved in it. There's, you know, like you could tell over a year's time that, you know, even in the conversation of just your name and your act is attracting more and more support from the record company, more and more support from people around it. I mean, you're starting to get a build up climbing that ladder.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like it's been a process because I'm not the only artist on the label, obviously. So there's like this whole term times where they're focusing on other projects and everything. But
sure.
I think what I meant more so is that I guess it follows the cliche of like being the little fish in the big pond, basically. And doing that, you have to have some humility. And it's kind of weird to basically ride this line of thinking, this stuff's really great, and I'm really proud of it, and then trying to prove it to people that you're like a worthy investment, basically, to keep supporting. And I think that's what artists have always had to do, like through the centuries, is always find those people who just really believed in them that have money that can support them, because usually artists aren't very good at supporting themselves.
Well, I also think, you know, for you, and you've done, a lot of your act has been solo with the guitar, especially, you know, we were talking about last time just in Sterling and in Iowa, other places where you're playing in the back of a bar. Mm-hmm. You know, even explaining the tours that you had in the last year where you're driving by yourself for hours at a time. And I mean, it is a solo. There's a lot of me, myself, and I when it comes to doing a show. And now as do you have to adjust to collaborate with other people, with the record label, with other people who are going to come on and you become less just about yourself and more about a small business?
Well, I think like there's two different worlds between the live show and the studio. I mean, the lessons I learned in the studio were not really about collaboration because I was always very open to that. I'm always very open to the idea of mixing other people's essences together, because like if you get three people to play a guitar riff, for example, but it's three different people, they're going to play it different ways just slightly if your ear is good enough to tell that. And so like when we got, you know, Rado from Foxton and Swift and the Whitney Boys and stuff, I was really open to that collaboration. What I learned really was mainly from Swift when I was with him about this idea that I originally had was it was trying to box myself in or hold myself back within a record. And thinking about the live show too much, instead it was more about, no, the album's the important thing. Hmm. And there's sounds on this record that I'm not going to be able to recreate live. I mean, not with the budget that I have right now. There's no way. But the record needed those sounds, basically. And I wasn't going to sacrifice them, or I learned not to sacrifice them for the sake of the live show. The live show is super secondary to the actual art itself. And that was a big lesson that I had to learn over this past year, basically.
What are we going to hear on this record? I mean, you know, as it comes out in June, I mean, what last time you were in, you were touring in support of the EP.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how you've evolved as a musician from that experience, from doing your first EP to the debut album, which comes out here in June.
Well, I think I just started to learn how to have more command over the studio. I think an irony for me is that I had this insecurity going into the studio the first time. I was doing demos and stuff by myself, and I was always very open to experimentation. And then I got in there and was just like, okay, I need to like make a cohesive record or something like that and just like get one sound on there. And it ended up being like really bland, some of these first drive-throughs that we were trying to do. And then I learned through Swift and some other people and just talking and just doing it myself, I was like, okay, well, actually my original idea was correct. It's like I can throw anything at the wall and whatever sticks is going to stick. And so this record, I think I'm proud of it because it's actually very variety-based. Like the songs that have been heard so far, High Beams and The Money Gets Bigger, are only little flavors of what else is on there. There's stuff on there that I don't think people expect of me, and I hope that people don't try to write it off as there's no way they're going to call it a folk record, that's
well,
for sure.
Well, I mean, I guess for me, I think about it and think about the last conversation calling back from a year ago. When you think about what you want to accomplish, and you say, okay, I'm gonna do a debut album. I'm gonna do this. I'm on the road. I'm also gonna get some downtime. I'm gonna do this. And you set that in motion to execute. How much of that is the original vision that you want to do, and how much did you learn that you had, you know, to be malleable? You had to be flexible when you're dealing with people like Richard Swift or other producers that are in studio saying, hey, you know, Trevor, let's go this way, let's go that way?
I'll say, like, one vision for it died and another came out of its ashes, basically. And I think that's the natural process of things. Now, I learned that I don't really work well with people who, the latter of what you're saying of, Trevor, let's do this and let's do that. When I worked with Swift and with Rado, it was more of a collaborative-based effort. I didn't go in there and they didn't treat me like I wasn't their equal or something. And I had had experiences before where that wasn't the case. And I think the art suffered for it, frankly, because I think I, unlike a lot of young people who are my age, I don't think I actually have like a pretty good concept of what I want to do. And it's just being allowed to do it is the case. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's aspects of like, okay, I gotta, you know, we're gonna do this take one more time or something like that because maybe he heard something funny. But overall, like, I don't know. Like, I just, the thing that I learned was that I work best with people that I collab with, not being dictated what to do. So maybe I didn't really learn how to do anything. I just learned that I know what I want and I better get it.
Hey, those are life lessons, man. Trevor Sensor, the singer-songwriter in studio tonight. His album Andy Warhol's Dream is going to be out in mid-June. He was just in town here at Shuba's. That record has some Chicago connections. The guys from Whitney, who were just in studio not too long ago, and also the producer credits, Richard Swift, who used to be in the Shins, is one of the producers on the record. Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back and we'll hear some live music from Trevor Sensor here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Continue our conversation and some live music here. Trevor Sensor in studio, the musician whose anticipated album Andy Warhol's Dream is coming out in June. He's just in town here in Chicago at Shuba's. He's got a record. He was here about a year ago here on the program. Singer-songwriter Trevor Sensor. Let's hear some music. Here is the track High Beams.
High beams, tightrope walking till the end of time. Where are my dreams? Brother, tell me, are you fine? I'm alone now, alone without bravery. And you told me, yes, you told me, I'll be somebody. I'm an angel, I'm a high priest waiting, still waiting. I'm a liar, I'm a fine beast praying. Oh, all I'm praying is still find me. Low down in the valley, I swear I'll find you there, milking your mother and licking all the tears. You're alone now, no, alone without the Lord. So cut off all your demons, all your tributes and adore. I'm an angel, no, I'm a high priest waiting, still waiting. Oh, no, no, I'm a liar, I'm a fine beast praying. Oh, yeah, praying, you still find me. We're bounded by ideas and greatness. Yeah, greatness and a kiss of grandeur. Oh, brother, I'm tired, not someone to do this anymore.
Trevor Sensor in studio tonight, the singer-songwriter. Of course, he was here a year ago. He's got his anticipated album, Andy Warhol's Dream. That was great, Trevor. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's do it again. Let's do another song before you go, because we have you and you have your guitar. What's the second song we're going to hear here?
It's called Starborn Eyes.
The pages of the past never seem the last. Everyone is wanting something they can't have. The devil's dead, lives in our heads, something that we've lost and can't bring back. But I want you to know that I think of you in the morning light, when the dawn was brand new and we slept until the afternoon. No, my cigarettes are gone, must have smoked them all. I was blind in love with you, not knowing I'd fall. And 3 years has left me drunk, a lonely starborn eyes. I see how everything goes away from you in time. Cause my life hasn't changed overall with my age. I'm still young, they say, till the flowers all die and melt away. No. And I heard what you say about me, how I always treated you wrong. I'll hide in my mountain, won't be missed when I'm finally gone. Oh, see faces in the dark, I hear the children bark, orders to their lord and to the cows. And the west will surely drown, I'm always feeling down, drinking bad beer and laying on the ground. Well, I know that times have changed. Your lover, he has a new name. He works in cosmetics, yet I'm the one who's to blame. Cause my life, it's a lie. Why do I even try to keep all my papers when none of them are truly mine?
Trevor Sensor in studio here on 720 WGN, the singer-songwriter. His anticipated album, Andy Warhol's Dream, is out in mid-June. He was just in town at Shuba's, and he's performing live tonight on The Download. Trevor, great to see you. Good luck with the career, and hopefully you'll be back a year from now. We can talk about how this last year's gone.
Absolutely. Let's just keep doing that every year.
Perfect.
We'll get back together.
Thank you, Rob. All right. About 15 minutes until Memorial Day weekend starts for us, Pete. Hey, I say let's play two. Is that a radio? That's not a radio thing.
No.
No.
Play two.
Let's play two. Let's do two shows. Let's do another four.
All right.
I'm sure Patty and company, everyone will be okay with that.
Take the night off.
Take the night off. We'll do another four.
We're here already.
We're already here. We've been here a long day. It's been a wonderful week here, WGN. The Walk of Fame, of course, was yesterday, which was a great event right here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny still today, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, they really have my feed has been populated with Walk of Fame pictures and stories.
Yes, it was a well documented event. I hate Instagram where you see things pop up that were 18 hours ago.
Well, they changed that in the last 6 months or 8 months. Remember, it used to be a real time app, and they changed it.
I don't like it.
And you don't like it.
Mm-mm.
You're just figuring that out right now.
I've hated it for a while.
Do you have any big plans, Pete, for the Memorial Day
weekend? Oh, man. I am going to be... Nah, not really. Riding Bike the Drive.
Yeah,
watching
that's
you
right.
MC the event.
I'm emceeing the Bike the Drive, MB Bike the Drive. I will be down at the Grant Park stage, 9:30 to 10:30.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go out and do a tight 25. Type 35 minute set I've been working on. A lot of, observations about biking. No, I mean, the band plays, I come up, I tell people what they did a good job and what they need to remember about biking. And then I introduce the next guest and then I come back and do it again and I'm done.
That's
I did it last year. It's fun. It's great. It's a tremendous, it reminds you that Chicago, especially in the summertime, there's so many different communities and so many groups of people that are doing big festivals, whether it be a walk or a street festival or a Bike the Drive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing to think about it because you're like, wow, there's thousands and thousands of people on the lakefront at 7:30 in the morning on a Sunday. And just for this one occasion to be able to ride the bike on Lakeshore Drive. And it's very humbling in the way that you're like, wow, this is a huge city. And there are a lot of people that want to do a lot of different things. Because I think about the weekend and I'm like, all right, so I'm excited because I'm like, okay, well, Sunday I'm going to do that. Monday I'm going to chill. I think about the weekend after. Here comes Blues Fest, Printer's Row. It starts to become like every hour, every weekend day gets filled with things that you can do.
I know. And once this weather starts to turn, get out of these 50s and rain.
Yeah. I'm very excited. One of the things I love to do in the summertime is just explore on a Sunday to street festivals or town festivals,
mm-hmm.
state fairs, county fairs, things like that. When we get closer to those days, then I'll reach out to some of the GN listeners and be like, hey, man, what should I be doing this weekend?
Someone
just mentioned, and this is a great one, we should do a segment on this. I always forget it. Every year I forget it. I did a big piece on it one time when I worked somewhere else. Harvard Milk Days.
What are those?
So Harvard, Illinois is a well-known, and it's probably not as prevalent as it was, decades ago, but it's well-known as a farm area and dairy farms. And so they had what was Harvard, Illinois' Milk Days.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the downtown area of Harvard, and I need to refresh my memory. It's been a long time since I've been there. Probably the last time I was there, I did a story on Motorola when they were starting. And the factory's not even there anymore. Mm-hmm. But this is when they brought it to there. So that's 15 years
ago. It's been a while.
It's been a while. But they had a cow right in the downtown Main Street that's like this cow statue.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like the cows on parade. And they would have a parade and they'd have a festival surrounding the idea of dairy and milk production. It's called Milk Days. And someone texted in tonight saying, don't forget about Milk Days. It's June 1st, 2nd, 3rd.
Oh, coming up next weekend. Yeah. All right.
That's cool. I mean, I remember it being a good time. I've been there a couple times when I was a kid.
Take a trip out there.
Yeah. I think it's next weekend. And then the weekend after that, I know is Lit Fest, Printer's Row Lit Fest, because I have 19 books I have to read before that festival for interviews.
Yeah, get the hammock out on Monday and just like pile through them.
Yeah, that's it, right? It's funny too because, you don't necessarily know, like, because I wanted to do a segment where, or a show. So we're going to do a Printer's Row Lit Fest preview show the Friday right before. And I wanted to do it where I'm like, some of the great authors of our time, American authors that are coming to Chicago, they're going to come on and they're going to sit down, almost like big table kind of sit downs about some of the great authors of our time and diverse, from people who are professors to others who are cultural critics, different topics, things like that. So we sort of went through the list and I looked at all the people and the PR people at the festival have been great and trying to get me the people. So anyway, I picked the people everything from history to racism. There's a book about racism. There's a book about there's essays, funny essays. There's a book, young adult book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, all right, well, I got to read all this stuff. So can you start sending it? So they've been coming in the last two or three days. I picked all the books that are like 500 pages.
You have.
I mean, I was just saying before the show, I mean, the thing is, it looks like a dictionary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just huge books. And I'm like, 500 plus pages for what's going to be a 15 to 20 minute interview.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so Jeff Carlin and I were talking before the show, producer on Rose Show. And he's like, he eyeballed the stack that I had, and he goes, it's going to be about 45 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have about 45 hours of reading to do before that. But I'm excited. I mean, that would be kind of fun, right? Like, to be like, all right, I'm going to be jacked up for that. It's going to be a very intense day of, like, trying to organize my thoughts and talk to each author about their specific work.
It's going to be like, you know, like the night before, you're going to be like, you have 8 books in your backpack.
Yeah,
cram for the read 8 books in the one day. All right, I got to cram, read all these things before tomorrow. You want to be fresh in your mind.
815, this is great news. I didn't understand this. 815, Orion Samuelson is going to be the MC of the milking contest on Saturday at Milk Days in Harvard.
I think you should go and watch that.
Harmelda the cow. Harmelda is the name of the cow.
Sidle up to Orion. And then maybe he can pass the torch to a Justin Kaufman. So you could do it for the next 50 or 60 years.
That's right. I go there and be like, and instead of passing the torch, it's essentially passing the teat because it's just milking cows. So Orion's like, I'm giving it to Justin. I'm like, and right then I just take it. I just start milking cow. I think that's how you do getting the.
Mm-hmm.
You don't put the article. It's just milking cow.
Yeah.
And from that point forward, I'm the guy for the next 50 years who does this ceremonial milking at the beginning of the parade. There's got to be a sound effect on a CD somewhere of milking sound.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. All right, here's what we're going to do. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll finish up the show, and then Patty Vasquez is coming in. Stay with us. Both baseball teams still playing tonight. Just saw that. They had a rain delay, and they started late on the game down at the Cell. The Sox hosting the Tigers, and, of course, the Cubs on the road in Los Angeles taking on the Dodgers. Both teams, the Sox actually have the lead 3-2. The Dodgers have the lead right now. Who's playing for the Dodgers these days? I know Clayton Kershaw, he pitches on Sunday, and then there's Yasiel Puig. But after that, I just kind of feel like, does Steve Sachs still play on that squad? Mike Marshall? Is Mike Marshall still playing first base? How about Pedro Guerrero? Ken Landro? Ken Landro still out and left? How about Alejandro Pena? Still closing out games for the Dodgers?
Yeah.
No? Just interested. Also, the Tigers. Who's playing for the Tigers these days? I know they got Miguel Cabrera and Justin Verlander, of course. But after that, Lou Whitaker? Is Lou Whitaker still playing second base? Alan Trammell? Trammell still holding down short? What about a Dwight Lowry? Is Dwight Lowry still? Jet Lemon?
Former White Sox, Chet Lemon.
Matt Noakes. The rookie sensation, Matt Noakes.
He was a rookie sensation.
He was a rookie sensation for the Tigers.
Was that when I had the game on, the White Sox game, because the Cubs were playing late, I tuned in and it was a rain delay, and it was just, you know, like Steve and Jason Benetti talking. I was like, speaking to Tommy Lasorda, let's see the highlights of the 1981 World Series.
Get Mel Allen out there.
Yeah.
This is This Week in Baseball. Is Frank Tanana, is he still?
Was he on the Tigers?
He was on the Tigers.
Remember on the Angels.
The Tigers had, looking at the late 80s Tigers, they had Freddie Lynn. I know, right? Gary Pettis and Chet Lemon in their outfield. Talking about, like, all those guys are probably in their 40s.
Yeah.
Right? Think about, like,
yeah,
the Tigers.
Fred Lynn was a Red Sox, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was old for the Red Sox in the mid-80s. Like, 83, he was, like, known in the 83 All-Star game, wasn't he? That's the one they always show in the highlight.
Yeah.
Freddie Lynn making a big catch and hitting a home run in an All-Star game with Bill Madlock.
I remember I recently was looking up Pete Rose for some reason, and like I loved Pete Rose when I was a kid, but like the Philly, you know, like I knew he played for the Reds, but I, you know, like the Philadelphia Phillies, mm-hmm. Pete Rose, like in the early 80s type of Pete Rose. So I like, I just happened to check to see like where he was in his career at the time. He was like 42 or something when I liked him.
When he was player manager,
he started like in 1961.
He was player manager for one of those teams, wasn't
he? I think for the Phillies. I mean, I think he may have been, maybe for the Reds. Did he go back to the Reds?
Yeah, you're right. But he was on the Padres, was he not? Maybe he wasn't on the Padres. He's on the Expos. No.
Yeah,
I feel like he was on all those teams. I think he was on every single team in Major League Baseball.
He started in 1963.
Wow.
He was 22. So, yeah, like say like in 1983 when I like was a fan, he was 42 years old. And like it's funny because I think back to those days and I think, oh, yeah, I loved Pete Rose when he was like in the, you know, at the prime of his career. But the prime of his, he was like 28 in 1969.
Eddie Murray played first base for the late 80s Dodgers. Do you know that?
No.
Is Tim Belcher still playing for the Dodgers these days? I could do this all night. John Tudor?
Yeah, John former, Tudor? Cardinal. I remember beating him on the Cardinals.
Mike Munoz? I think of who the big save guys were for the Dodgers in the late 90s or late 80s. I feel like it was like, here it's got Jay Howell. I don't know who Jay Howell is. He doesn't really hold up.
Since I was moving too, I also I had some baseball cards. Like most of my baseball cards were lost in the flood. These are in quotes. That's what when I went over, they retrieved them. That's what my parents said. Mm-hmm. I think they just got rid of them. But I had, I don't know, like 12 or 15 cards, just random baseball cards from like 1981 or something. And like 12 cards, 3 Burt Blylevins out of the 12 cards. I was like a typical pack.
Oh, the texters are coming in now. 773 says, hey, is Nick Asaski still on the Reds? 6-3, I was like, whatever happened to Mark Vidrich?
Oh, yeah, the bird.
Candy Maldonado. We got a reference earlier in the week. Al, is it Al Kaline?
Al Kaline?
Kaline? Rick Monday? Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
This should be a bit, just naming old baseball players
from
the 70s,
80s. It's the best thing ever, is it not? There's no there's no beginning, middle, end. There's no conflict. There's no games. There's no rules. It's just naming 80s baseball players. Yeah. That's how we end our Memorial Day weekend preview show. The last 2 minutes of the download is naming 80s baseball players. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say, play WGN Radio. Patty Vasquez up next. Next week, we'll be back on Tuesday. Next week, this is great. We got Mike Watt from the Minutemen, Dimitri Martin, great comedians. Got the movie Dean coming out. Anna and David Posey, restaurateurs, chefs from Elsky. So great, great shows coming up next week here on The Download. Have a great, safe Memorial Day weekend. Let's go to the news sponsored by helpme.megapros.com. Rob, enjoy yourself. I'll see you on Tuesday, buddy.
You know what the most fun I'm going to have?
Oh, my God.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
Gentlemen!
Thank you.
Oh, I cannot wait, man. We're going to spend the whole first... When we get back on Tuesday, it's going to be...
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, it's going to be like 2 hours.
Have a great weekend, my friend.
You too, buddy.
Take care.